Hello everyone and welcome to our lunch and learn this afternoon, where we're looking at preparing for a car audit. My name is Elaine Tai and I head up the marketing for FSCom, and I'm delighted to introduce your presenter for today's session, Jamie Cook. Now, you may notice you can't see me today because I'm having some technical difficulties. So, Jamie will make up for it because you will see Jamie for the rest of the session, and you'll hear my voice coming and going. So, look, as I said, Jamie is going to be the presenter for today. He is co-founder in FSCom, and he is also the head of investments. So, Jamie's very well placed to share his knowledge of best practice in this area. Look, first of all, the usual housekeeping, reminding you all that the session is being recorded and it will be available on demand from our website in the next few days, and we'll let you know when that is available. Please use the session to ask any questions you have in the chat area at the side, and then I'll pose them to Jamie at the Q&A section later. There are a couple of polls, so I'll jump in and out to pose those questions. It'll keep everybody engaged, and yeah, hopefully you'll learn a lot today. So look, without further ado, I'm passing across to Jamie.
Thank you, Elaine. Welcome everyone this afternoon to as Elaine said, the lunch and learn focused around preparing for your car audit. This is great to welcome people to an online webinar. It would be even better to be able to do this face to face, but obviously circumstances dictate that we're not able to do that. But for me, this session should be and is always better a bit more interactive because the focus today is not getting into the granular detail of the Client Asset Regulations 2017. It's about outlining what are the practical considerations and steps you should be taking for your client asset examination. In terms of just an overview of my background, I've been a regulatory consultant for 15 years. I focus the majority of my time around investments, both from a UK and from an Ireland perspective. But I also have spent several interim roles where I have been the head of client asset oversight. So I suppose the lens that I'm talking through is one both as an external consultant, but having had the benefit of being in-house and understanding some of the practical challenges. It's also probably an opportune moment to be able to host a seminar such as this because some firms or some attendees may be going through the field work in relation to into their client asset examination aligned to the calendar year end. And for some attendees, it may be that actually you're getting yourselves prepared for a March year end and therefore the field work happening in Q1 next year. So hopefully you find this useful and we're looking forward to getting some feedback in the polls so that it can be a bit more interactive. So in terms of what we want to address today, we really want to look at the background and the scope of CAR. So what it is, whilst we don't necessarily particularly want to go into the depths of the regulations or the requirements, what we do want is to just basically touch upon where the client asset examination requirement has come from. To talk to Section 65 or Regulation 65 with the client asset examination in CAR 2017. So what are those requirements? Outline what your risk and control framework should look like when it comes up to the audit, and that's pretty critical in my eyes to be able to demonstrate to the auditors that you have sufficiently mapped out where the risks are, where the, I suppose, the mapping across to the rules, and also where how you provide a control environment to ensure that you're mitigating those risks. Then to touch upon auditor communication. So auditor communication is always clearly one of the critical points when it comes to having a successful client asset examination. And then coming towards the end, just touch upon a bit more practical points. So what would I say from my experience of having been involved on the inside of a client asset examination, but equally having consulted around preparing for a client asset examination or the output of an examination, what are some of the practical considerations to ensure that you have the most successful examination that you could have? And then just briefly touch upon at the end some of the proposed changes, obviously, to the client asset requirements from the consultation paper CP133 that I appreciate was issued almost a year ago, but really just to reinforce what those key changes are going to be. We're going to focus today as well on also the client asset requirements. We're not going to focus on the investor money requirements, and it's just to really highlight that that is really the focus and what we want to really drill into today. So Elaine, if we could just hand over to you, I think it's opportune actually if we just have a poll now to try and get an understanding from the attendees where they currently are in terms of the process. Are they going through the client asset examination process, or is that going to happen potentially Q1 next year?
Okay, thanks, Jamie. So the poll's up there now, please. Everybody cast their vote. Are you currently going through a client asset examination process? And very simply, yes or no. So everybody take their time there and cast your vote, and then we'll be able to close the poll and share the results. But look, we'll give everybody a couple of seconds there to do that. And Niamh, when you're happy enough, the majority of people have cast their votes, please feel free to close the poll and share the results. Oh, okay. Very even there, Jamie. 50% are currently going through a client asset examination process and 50% are not. Thanks, Niamh. Close that.
Thanks, Niamh. Thanks, Elaine. And probably what we would have expected going into the poll. So I suspect some people are going through the field work currently because obviously the period end being the 31st of December. And if another common period end would obviously be aligned to a March year end, and therefore that is sort of the going through the fieldwork maybe Q1 next year. So very quickly, I suppose, let's just touch upon where the client asset requirements have come from. And the first iteration of the client asset requirements obviously came in with MiFID. And applied from the 1st of November 2007. It was sort of codified in Ireland through a statutory instrument, which was number 60 of that year of 2007. But importantly, the requirements were actually contained within Regulation 79, so it didn't necessarily have its own standalone set of regulations and legislation. And ultimately then what happened, you have the client asset regulations too, as I would refer to it, and that was a separate statutory instrument that came in 2015, statutory instrument 104 of that year. And I suppose the fact that it had its own statutory instrument sort of highlights the importance that both the legislators and also the Central Bank of Ireland wanted to place upon client assets. And it transposes some of the MiFID requirements, but definitely went further. And I think the change was clearly driven by certain events. You had obviously the fallout from the financial crisis, but probably more importantly, you had some issues in and around custom house capital, which has obviously been very well publicised in Ireland. And then more importantly, we obviously have the current iteration of the client assets, which is basically an update to the client asset regulations 2015. And that came into force on the 3rd of January. And that is not very snappily titled, but it is the Central Bank Act 2013, section 48.1 of the Investment Firm Regulations 2017. And for the purposes of this lunch and learn, I will refer to this as the Client Asset Regs or CAR 2017. If nothing else, we'll not get much further if I continue to have to repeat the actual legislative title. And I sort of alluded earlier on just to the scope of the client asset requirements versus the investor money requirements. And I think that's summarized pretty neatly in that table. So the client asset requirements will apply to MiFID investment firms, and it applies to any investment business that's authorized under the IIA Act 1995. It also applies to UCITS management companies and also alternative investment fund managers. The investor money requirements applies to a broader cohort, which are listed there, which is focused around fund service providers, management companies or general partners under the Investment Limited Partnerships Acts, and any credit institutions acting as a depository for any investment funds. I think the delineation between CAR and IMR is reflecting really different operating models between FSPs, for example, and MiFID investment firms, and therefore the belief was that we should have separate sets of requirements. So moving on to the importance of CAR, and you know, clearly the client asset regime plays a critical role in ensuring that which consumer confidence, and it's fundamental to ultimately linking to what the central bank I suppose objectives are as well, which is to maintain consumer confidence in markets. And you can see that obviously the CAR regime critical to doing that, and it really wants to ensure that there is confidence within the financial services sector, and that people who invest in the financial services sector have protections around their money. Also clearly minimize the risk of loss or misuse of client assets by investment firms. And latterly, in the event that there is an insolvency, and you know, Customs House Capital shows that there can clearly be large-scale insolvencies, that there is a safe and efficient return of those assets to clients. And I think, you know, just reflecting recently on some of the publicity around the ruling in October around Customs House Capital, I think that last one probably is the most relevant one. And we saw very well publicised that the ICCCL applied and went to the High Court for a ruling in relation to obviously unlocking circa €12 million worth of compensation payments relating to Customs House Capital. And what's interesting, I suppose, with regard to that ruling and linking to the importance of CAR is we're now nearly a decade or you know, we are a decade to when the actual misappropriation and insolvency occurred in Customs House Capital. And at this point, only €7.4 million of compensation payments have been made to 574 investors from Customs House Capital. And that occurred in 2019. And nearly a decade on, there is still 1,400 individuals who are seeking compensation payments to around the tune of 12 million. It's actually €12.3 million. And the problem that was, I suppose, alluded to by Justice Heslin in the October ruling was that it's not possible to, I suppose, say if investors actually have been fully compensated for their loss because they've been repatriated or reimbursed with their investment assets. But that's nearly a decade after the actual loss occurred, and therefore clearly is that full compensation for the loss that they suffered, has that put them into the position that they were in prior to investing? The chances and the likelihood is that it's not. So it's really, really important that the client assets regime not only minimises risk of loss, but in the event that that does happen, there is safe and efficient and timely return of those assets back to clients, and you shouldn't have a 10-year time horizon. And I think you can see that that's critical, and that's why the client assets regime exists. So just reaching out again to another quick poll as well, and it's leading on to something just I want to touch upon in the next slide, moving into the actual audit process. Have any attend attendees ever changed their auditor because they felt that the auditor didn't actually understand the firm's business model.
Okay, thanks, Jamie. So yeah, as Jamie said, the poll is now up. And again, simple, yes or no, have you ever changed your auditor because they don't understand your business model? So there may be other reasons that you've changed your auditor, but have you ever changed the auditor because they don't understand your business model? So giving everybody a couple of more seconds to cast their vote, yes, you've changed your auditor because they don't understand your business model, or no, you never have. Okay, when everybody has voted, Niamh, feel free to close and share the results. Thank you. Okay, so very few. That's good news, Jamie, isn't it? 14% have never changed, or is it good news? Have ever changed their auditor because they don't understand your business model? 86% have not.
So I love the enthusiasm trying to liven up have you ever changed your auditor question. Ultimately, I don't think it can be defined as good or bad news. What I would say is that there certainly should be consideration that you would change your auditor, because ultimately, if the auditor doesn't really understand the business model, it can lead to a prolonged audit. It could lead to potential material delays within the 4-month submission window of the audit report. But more importantly, it's probably relatively costly. And I've certainly been involved in audits where we've brought in a new auditor for the first time, and there is a prolonged period of time for them to particularly understand the business model. And why do they need to understand the business model? Well, one, fundamentally, it feeds into their ability to understand when funds received become client assets, and ultimately when that obligation expires. And you know that, yes, it can be communicated and should be communicated by the firm very clearly through funds flow mapping, but ultimately it also presents, if your auditor has that background and experience, it definitely makes for a more efficient audit process, which equals a lower cost audit process as well. So what are the client asset requirements? And it was set out formally in section 9 of CAR 2015, but under the CAR 2017 requirements, it's outlined in Regulation 65. So in part 6 of the very snappily titled 2013 Act Investment Firm Regulations 2017, it's outlined in Regulation 65. And some of these sort of high level requirements are you obviously still have to have your external assurance report. You've got to ensure that the auditor has the necessary skills and resources. And I think that feeds into why I asked the question around the poll, to see, do firms consider whether the auditors have those skills and resources to be able to understand the business and to be able to conduct an efficient audit? And if you don't, then obviously you should consider changing the auditor. And I appreciate there is probably an element of nervousness around whenever you change an auditor, and what that may portray to the central bank. But for me, it's very clear that it's set down in legislation that it is a requirement that you consider the skills and resources. So I suppose it's a understandable knock-on effect that you may wish to change. But it's clearly important that obviously the firm provides cooperation in a timely fashion to the auditors as well. The scope, I suppose, of any audit report should be looking at, have they maintained the processes and the systems to meet the requirements? And that will look at things such as the CAMP document, the CACID document, your reconciliations, your MCAR reports and returns. It also needs to ensure that it's making a view as to whether the firm is compliant at the end of the period. So there could be potential breaches that have occurred during the course of the period, but more importantly, they have been closed by the period end. It really wants to dial in, is there any divergence between, I suppose, the CAMP and the client asset management plan, and also what happens in operational practice. And one of the key areas, I suppose, for the CAMP is that it not only acts as a document that outlines your risk and your controls and should map obviously to the client asset requirements, but it equally needs to act as a form of resolution plan. So in the event of insolvency, someone can come in and be able to effectively wind down the business based on that particular document. So any divergence between your camp and what happens in operational practice is going to have a knock-on effect to the efficient winding down of the business and ultimately the repatriation of funds to customers or assets. It also clearly needs to look as well at any changes to the camp and do they have sufficient detail on what the potential risks are to protection of assets. The board obviously needs to be able to, I suppose, assess the findings of the audit report, and that's critical because the board will retain ultimate responsibility. And then there needs to be the submission of the report within 4 months. And latterly, looking at, well, changes to any remediation deadlines need to be submitted to the central bank. So if you commit to a remediation time frame and you're failing to hit that, then you obviously need to do a notification, which is outlined under Regulation 68.1D. And importantly, if the firm claims or does not hold any client assets during the reporting period or during the financial period, then you still need to instruct the auditor so that they can conduct sufficient testing to be able to confirm that position as well. So that's a broad overview of what the client asset examination requirements are. So one of the things I think is critical when we're thinking about preparing for the CAR or the client asset examination is looking at the risk and control framework as well. So for me, it's pretty critical that your risk and control framework and your footprint when it comes to client assets is well documented, because that's going to be critical for the auditor to be able to understand where assets effectively arise. So where funds that are held or where financial instruments that are held actually fall under the client asset requirements. How you therefore then treat those in terms of where they're held and the protections that they're afforded, and equally where they cease to become funds or financial instruments under the client assets requirements. And I suppose critical in that is also just thinking about funds flow diagrams as well. And I had a conversation recently with an auditor in advance of a client asset examination, and one of the things that they had communicated to me was the firm in the previous examination had some remediation actions very clearly linked to being able to explain the funds flow and being able to identify when ultimately it needs to be protected and when that protection should cease and how that is mapped through to the client asset requirements. So it's important that you do that, and if you provide, I suppose, clear and useful information around those particular areas, then inevitably it's going to lead to a more efficient audit, which inevitably leads to a lower cost audit. It's critical to understand the legislation and the CAR guidance, and again be able to explain how that applies to the firm's business model. And often we probably think, well, that's taken as granted, but I have been involved in client asset examinations and also CAS examinations in the UK, where my interpretation has been that actually the firm and the client asset oversight or the head of client asset oversight ultimately doesn't fully understand the firm's business model and hasn't gone through the detailed mapping process so that they can outline where the requirements apply to the business model and where they don't. And more importantly, where they don't, it shouldn't be you're writing non-applicable. It should be that you're giving a detailed explanation as to why you believe it doesn't apply. There's also, I suppose, an expectation that your camp should, I suppose, do the line analysis to the roles. And again, there should be the risk and control mapping. So where do we, not only where do we feel the roles apply, and this should be documented in the camp, but equally, where do we feel that the risks are going to be with regards to us holding client assets? And what do we do to mitigate that risk? And what are our procedures in order to ensure that they are effective as well? And like any risk and control framework, and anyone on this call will be very comfortable with this approach. I mean, it is a living document, and it should be updated to reflect any changes. So, you know, your camp shouldn't be a static document, and ultimately you should make sure that actually it is reflecting any changes. And those changes could be, for example, new product launches, it could be a different operational approach that therefore then ultimately impacts on how you protect client assets, and that therefore then needs to be reflected in an updated camp. And it shouldn't be that that waits for your annual review. It should be that that is being updated, and clearly the version history you would expect to be able to sort of map across to any changes. And I suppose what I would always say as well is that you need to ensure that you've got, I suppose, an effective monitoring plan, because it shouldn't really be down to the audit process to identify any breaches. You would expect that actually if you have an effective second line, that should be identifying any breaches in your client asset policies and procedures and systems and controls, and therefore it is early identification rather than being identified by the audit examination. And lastly, I suppose auditors will clearly look to assess the controls and the processes for recording and resolving breaches as well. So not only making sure your breaches log is updated and is also updated alongside a reference to the breach mapped to obviously the client asset requirements, but equally that you've recorded how you've resolved that, and you've recorded as well any mitigants to ensure that that wouldn't reoccur. And I think making sure that you're undertaking that process is going to be pretty critical to how successful an audit you have. So I suppose one of the most important things I think for me is in and around auditor communication. And again, you know, my experience is I've been privy to and consulted on several client asset examinations, or numerous, and also both in the UK and Ireland. And I think one of the things is where you have a negative outcome, so there's a lot of remedial actions, or indeed in the UK, if you have an adverse opinion, ultimately, one of the things that comes up time and time and time again is the lack of communication, the lack of engagement between the auditor team and also the in-house team within the firm. And that might not only be actually it's a case that they didn't necessarily provide all the preparatory work, it might be that they didn't actually have the time, the in-house team, to be able to prepare. So for me, this is a pretty important slide in terms of being able to achieve a successful outcome. So your regular and clear comms will ultimately clearly help the process run smoothly. And that's probably common sense, but it's an important point to reinforce. And that's, for me, not just during the fieldwork exercise. So obviously what you should always do is ensure that you've got a clear plan in place when it comes to the start of the fieldwork, right the way through to the submission. But there's clearly a lot of technical points within the client asset requirements. And what often that means is you might need to have very technical discussions with your auditors. And those technical meetings should take place as early as possible and can take place during the course of the year to ensure that it's not going to be outstanding whenever it comes to doing the fieldwork. Ultimately, there's a fairly short time frame between doing the fieldwork and the period end. And clearly, you don't want any points outstanding at the period end. And so therefore, making sure that you have technical discussions early on are pretty critical. And in any technical discussion, what is important is that you don't necessarily have to get agreement with auditors, but you have to be able to present a strong enough argument that actually you have addressed all of the potential concerns around why you took a position with regards to client asset requirements that was contrary to what the auditor thought. You're still ensuring that you're protecting client assets, and that's ultimately what they will want to see. And they'll want to see, for example, how you have ensured that client assets can be protected, how it could be in the event of insolvency, they would remain protected and could be distributed. But equally, they will also want to see within any technical argument, again, mapping across to any requirements and your argument as to whether you think those arguments apply or in fact don't apply. So technical meetings should happen and early on, and equally you need to put a fair degree of effort into presenting why you believe your technical point is right, with the lens of making sure that it protects client assets. And I've got in bold and underlined there as well about hiring the right auditors, and it feeds back into the poll as well. So, I've again alluded to, I've been involved in some audits where I felt that the auditors weren't right. They didn't necessarily understand the business. They may have come, for example, from a funds background as opposed to a investment firm background, and therefore didn't fully understand the business model, but probably more importantly, didn't understand the product set either. I think obviously early visibility of deliverables list is pretty critical as well. And for me, that is making sure that if you're starting field work mid-November, that you have that deliverables list well in advance. And as early as you can get it, the better it's going to be, because it takes a long time to compile, and it may require you to go to third parties, such as any third-party confirmations from banks. And therefore, getting early visibility of the deliverables list ensures that you can make sure that you have the pack ready for the fieldwork. And think about potentially incorporating this into your year-end processes as well. So often, you will have a year-end process that is run by the finance team, and some of that may be duplicated in terms of what you need to provide for your client asset examination. So if you can try and effectively make your deliverables and make your as a year-end process, then it means that it's not being left behind, and it's always routinely being done. I think the last point here is also for me probably one of the most pertinent ones as well, which is make sure you've got key points of contact for fieldwork requests, and then set aside time for your staff, because often they can be busy on the operational day-to-day requirements, but as we all know, there is an extraordinary amount of work involved in a client asset examination, and clearly the key people involved in that process need to have time set aside so that they can dedicate that to the auditor's requirements, and make sure that you have key points of contact. And often think of practical things like, if the team that is working on the client asset examination, have we reviewed and thought about their annual leave? Are they taking annual leave across this potential fieldwork period that may impact the process? To some very pragmatic points like that, you should consider as well. So moving on to just some practical points from my experience. I mean, I suppose it goes without saying, make sure all your internal documents are up to date. So, your CAMP, your CACID, your terms of business, and any sort of consent arrangements around collateral or TTCA. So, and if we look at where the CP 133 is going, I mean, it's trying to tighten up and reinforce that you have documented arrangements for any transfer of collateral. So clearly, it's really critically important that you have all of that documentation up to date. And when you're thinking about your terms of business, things such as the arrangements that you have for receipt of assets, any third party details as well, and any pooling arrangements should clearly be explained in your terms of business. I think where it's applicable and where it's required, both from a risk management perspective, but potentially even from a regulatory perspective, those internal documents that need to be reviewed and approved annually to ensure that that is being done. So your camp and your package should have annual approvals, and make sure, as I alluded to before, that any changes are you can sort of reconcile through to the version history. And as I sort of said as well, I mean, the camp is a resolution plan as well. So changes, for example, in relation to where documents are stored, such as reconciliations, if that's in your camp and that has changed, then camp should be updated to reflect that. Clearly check to ensure all of your daily reconciliations and calculations are stored and readily available, so that they can be reproduced. Ensure that all sort of client trust accounts with third parties are reconciled with the third party confirmations, and any funds facilities agreements are all updated as well, because often what you can find is it's not the case that that you may have added on accounts and that those accounts may be covered under a historical funds facility agreement, and therefore you would need that document updated. And you would also need, obviously, the third party confirmation as well. So make sure all of that is sort of reviewed and reconciled, and that you have that available. And one point as well, reviewing and I suppose ensure your internal accounts are designated correctly. So obviously the client asset requirements mandate that you must also designate your internal ledgers and your internal systems. The accounts must be designated correctly, so make sure that that has been done. And similarly, if there's been any changes during the course of the year, that those are being reconciled and reviewed to ensure that they are updated and are designated correctly. And obviously review last year points and ensure that there's no reoccurrence. So you know, one of the concerns being that if you continually have the same remediation action year on year, then that's clearly going to have a negative consequence with the Central Bank of Ireland. So make sure that those review points are not reoccurring. Again, another very practical thing, your returns, so your MCARs should be complete and again, or have you got them in a pack that can be made available. And lastly, just thinking and looking at any breaches logs and notifications, again, are updated and are available as well. So just moving on to sort of some of the proposed changes, and I hope what we've outlined there in terms of some of the practical considerations that you know we have come across and we have experienced is useful, and I suppose hopefully provides a bit of guidance on, well, how do we prepare effectively for our client asset examination you find useful. Maybe just looking a bit more, I suppose, to the future, and it does link in to what we're talking about in terms of preparing for your audits. So some of the changes that we have seen fall out of CP 133, which was published in December 2020. And it's proposing amendments to the Central Bank Act 2013, Investment Firm Regulations 2017. And the consultation closed in March 21. And some of the proposed enhancements are, they want to broaden the definition of investment firms to include credit institutions who undertake MiFID business. They want new client disclosure and consent requirements. So again, they really want to focus in on things such as, you know, client financial instruments and ensuring that you've got express prior consent for any sort of securities financing arrangements. Title transfer, collateral arrangements, that there's written agreements in a durable medium, you know, so where the client is transferring ownership of those funds, that clearly there is written agreement.
they want in terms of around prime brokerage arrangements, that there's regular reporting on the assets. So ultimately, investors have accurate and timely information. So they're trying to enhance the client disclosure and consent requirements. Guidance on how client assets should be segregated as well. So clearly, one of the principles of the client asset requirements is segregation, and probably one of, if not the most fundamental. And there's further additional guidance on what the CBI's expectations are. And what they're also proposing is to try and hard code, so I put into legislation some existing requirements around reconciliations, treatments for difference and other shortfalls. So, and that'll be pretty important, because if that's been hard coded into legislation, then there's clearly a fixed and requirement to do it, and therefore any failures to do so would be obviously a clear breach. And so they want to try and hard code some of those, and that's particularly around client financial instruments as well. And lastly, some enhancements to the CAMP document as well. So things such as a client asset applicability matrix. So where does effectively a map of where the assets rise within the business model. And equally, things such as outsourcing, they want included in the CAMP document. And I think we all would agree that outsourcing is very much a focus of the central bank. And what they want to do is ensure that the firm has absolute clarity of where outsourcing arrangements arise within their systems and controls around client assets, and how the firm maintains strong oversight of those arrangements as well. I suppose the other thing is that they're being very, very clear around the CAMP and board oversight as well. So, you know, thinking and linking back to the upcoming SEER regime, making sure that there is clarity around roles and responsibilities and oversight is going to be pretty fundamental as well. So, Elaine, I'm right on the button of 12:45, and that definitely wasn't planned. But maybe if I could just hand over, Elaine, if there's any sort of questions that have come from the audience.
Yeah, Jamie, yes, very impressed. I have to say, on your timing there, right on the button, as you say. Okay, so look, first number of questions here. So thanks everybody who's put in a few questions. First one up then, Jamie, what steps, so you talked there about CP133, so what steps should we be taking to ensure we're complying with the enhancements to CAR that are emanating from that CP133?
I would suspect probably a lot of firms have already taken steps, because it is, you know, a consultation came out 12 months ago, but I think the attendee list is not necessarily credit institution focused. What I would say just at the outset is that if you are a credit institution, then clearly it's a very broad exercise, because there's a whole new set of requirements that you'll not have come across. So clearly they need to be sort of looking into what the CAR, I suppose CAR means for them, and ensuring that they're designing systems and procedures to adhere to the CAR requirements. I think for the broader cohort of investment firms, it's making sure that they're reviewing the consultation paper, understanding any of the changes, examining their controls and processes around reconciliation and the treatment of differences, because these will now have legislative footing. And a big part for me of what the CP133 was saying was around enhancements to the CAMP. So ensure that they reviewed the CAMP document and made sure that any of the proposed changes are reflected in that. And lastly, what I'd also say is just assess the possible impacts that the changes could have on obviously your client asset examination, but equally also any internal audit work that you have as well. So not only, I suppose, in a staged approach, reviewing the changes, implementing the changes, and then ensuring that from an audit perspective, i.e. your third line, that you are, those changes have the strongest control environment that you can.
Okay, thanks, Jamie. Next question then here from one of the attendees. We would settle some investment products into our payments company to allow for onward transition. How should this be addressed from a CAR perspective?
Yeah, so I've come across this actually a couple of times, and you maybe see this a bit more, you know, we're seeing a bit more of the emergence of the payment services sector in Ireland. But I suppose what I suspect is happening there is that when an investment firm enters into an FX option product, for example, ultimately the settlement of those proceeds would go into the client's account with its sister company, which would be a payment services institution or an authorized payments institution, and that allows it to do the onward distribution to third parties, which is a regulated payment service activity. So, you know, as a operational model, I've seen that several times. What you must do there, in my view, is make sure that when you're doing your funds flow mapping, that you are being very clear around when it becomes client assets under the client assets requirements. From an investment firm perspective, when does that obligation end? And when, more critically as well, when does it become relevant funds under the payment services regulations? And again, similarly, when does that obligation end? And I think any client asset examination and any auditor would want to be able to see that being mapped all the way through. And a secondary point, I suppose, for me on that is making sure that any documentation reflects that process and reflects when the requirements start and end. So, for example, there's absolute clarity on the terms of business as to when it is being treated as client assets and when that treatment ceases, and similarly how that bridge occurs to the payment services terms of business as well. And latterly, what I would say from the website perspective is that that should also be very clear in terms of any commentary around protection of client assets.
Okay, great, thanks, Jamie. Okay, another question here on IT controls. So, yeah, how important, I suppose, in your opinion, how important are IT general controls to the client asset examination?
Pretty fundamental. I'm sure auditors would agree with me on that. So, you know, ultimately the IT general controls will be really relevant when it comes to, in particular, things like reconciliation. So if you're doing your internal reconciliation and that is reliant on information that is coming from IT systems, then ensuring that there is a strong IT general control framework around that gives the auditor comfort that that information cannot be manipulated by the firm. So it's absolutely fundamental. Now, if for example, that they can't get satisfaction around the IT general controls, what would happen? Well, it means that they have to do a lot more audit work to be able to understand the veracity of the information and make sure that is representing effectively a true view of that. And ultimately, that will clearly lead to a longer and more costly approach or costly audit. So, yeah, I think it's pretty fundamental that the IT general controls are sound. Lena, are you still there?
Apologies, Jamie. Yes, I am. I couldn't. Some technical difficulties today, as I said earlier. That's why you can't see my face today. Lucky for all of you. Okay, so Jamie, last question that I can see anyway, unless anyone wants to jump in with another one. And last question then, what would be the CBI response to negative client asset examination? So what would be the central bank's response to negative client asset examinations?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose a negative examination is, for me, is where you're continually getting a lot of remedial actions and also continuing matters, so that you've got a remedial action that is similar year on year. I mean, clearly the CPI response is not going to be positive to that. I think to answer the question, what is the knock-on effect of that? The knock-on effect of it could definitely lead to what they would call a targeted review, where they would want an independent auditor to go in and do a deeper dive into that particular remedial area that they're not satisfied around. So I think that for me is ultimately probably what the next step would be. I mean, you don't continually want to have negative client asset examinations or negative results from that, because it will lead to further regulatory action, and in particular continuing matters therefore then are indicative of what is probably a more deeper rooted and systemic problem within the firm, that they can't resolve, or worse, are choosing not to resolve. And so ultimately, I think that would be the outcome.
Okay. Thanks, Jimmy. That seems to be all the questions, you'll be happy to know. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Jamie. And thank you, everyone who's attended today. We hopefully you find that session useful and taken away some practical actions from it. So look, as usual, you'll receive the follow-up email tomorrow with a link to the recording. And also just to let you know, we are currently finalizing our Lunch and Learn webinars for 2022. And we'll be kickstarting that with a couple of regulatory outlook sessions. So keep an eye out for those and feel free to sign up. So look, that's it from us, unless Jimmy, you have any final words of wisdom?
No, I think there's probably a lot in there, but just to say thank you to everyone for attending. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it's an important area.
Brilliant. Thanks, Jimmy. Look, that's it from us. Thanks, everybody, for your attention and especially for your engagement this afternoon. And enjoy the rest of your day. Take care. Bye-bye.